exactly 39 years later. It's January 1967. Prabhupada had just arrived in our midst, San Francisco, during the eve. This was the eve of probably one of the world's greatest changes of consciousness since Christianity, since other historical events perhaps, but the wave of change that was coming over the world at that time in the late 1960s had not been experienced on this planet for hundreds of years. This was the time of absolute change when the world, the entire globe, became seized by the idea that anything was possible. Everything was possible. So imagine we're in a small storefront on a busy street in San Francisco. Prabhupada has just arrived a few days before.
Did you first see him at the airport?
Yes. So we're waiting for him to come down. You can imagine this small room with maybe 20, 25 young boys and girls who had just met Srila Prabhupada. A few boys and girls from New York who had known him for maybe 1 year at the most. And five or six new people, perhaps some of them sleeping on the floor or going like this in the corner, coming down from some LSD trip. Or they're hungry, they're just waiting for breakfast. This period, the mid to late 1960s, was a revolutionary period, a very interesting period looking back. But at the time, we were all swept up in it, like being in the powers of a wave on the coast. The big wave, the tidal wave is coming, and you're caught up in it. There's no tomorrow, there's no yesterday, it's just now. And it's a time of extreme activity and energy. The youth of an entire nation, the world's leading nation, the youth of Europe, and to some extent the rest of the world was to follow, was suddenly uprooted from any kind of tradition or past. And a new world seemed to be on the horizon. Everyone was excitedly looking for the new world, the new way of being, the new life. Many things were responsible for this. There's no reason to go into a historical analysis. But one of the major causes of this change of consciousness was a drug called LSD, lysergic acid diethylamine or something like that. Now, this is a very strange drug that young people started taking. This drug, if you take a small quantity, I'm only describing this because probably most people don't know about this chemical and what it did. It's been underplayed, the part of this particular drug. What it did to change the entire world. It was cheaply available, being made by students and chemistry students in colleges and distributed widely. But this, what it did was, wherever you were, this room or on the street or in nature, in the mountains, on the beach, wherever you took this drug, everything you saw and everything you heard with your normal senses suddenly became expanded. The same mountains were there, same streets were there, but they became glorified in a way that was awesome, breathtaking. The clouds and the skies and the beaches and the people, everything became so beautiful, so glorious, beyond anyone's experience. And it was happening around you and in you at the same time. It wasn't something you were observing from afar. It was happening with you and in you. These were, they called many names, but the doorways to perception were opened. And this vision that people had, and then when the drug lasted about 12 hours, and then you came back to your reality, to the normal sensory perception that we have with the world. So after such an experience, anyone who took this drug became convinced completely that there was another reality, that this was not the only reality, what we were seeing with our normal eyes and ears. There is an alternate reality, a higher reality, full of beauty and wisdom and music and glorious feeling of well-being. This was our glimpse of heaven. So young people began gathering as if by invitation, although it was all done spontaneously, gathering into groups of seekers, people looking for, where is this reality? How can we find it? We all knew that by taking this drug, we would again have to come back to, we would come down and back into our standard reality. There was no way to capture this place, this alternate reality, and hold on to it. So people began looking for gurus. They began looking for teachers. They began looking for ways of understanding this alternate reality and being able to achieve it naturally or through some traditional means. How can we find out? And many people came forward. So many so-called gurus came forward. Ah, we know the way. We know the way. I know the way. So many leaders who came to take the young people their way. But after so much searching around, most people began to feel very disappointed in these kinds of leaders because they didn't really capture this alternate reality. But the moment that Srila Prabhupada came into our midst, I mean, it's a miracle. It's one of the magic things of history that Prabhupada came through that little tiny window, little teeny tiny window. He was born in 1896. I mean, that's in the 19th century, and his whole life evolved for him to jump through this tiny window into our homes, into our lives. As soon as we saw him and began to observe him and listen to him, we knew immediately we had found someone who could take us to this higher place. So the times were like this. Prabhupada, when he came, he had nothing in terms of props. We didn't have these wonderful deities. We didn't have any idea. Even practically, it was months before we had an idea of what Krishna looked like. We didn't have any books. Srila Prabhupada had translated some three cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, and they were distributed among us, so we began to get some idea from the reading about Krishna, but not much. We didn't have any rituals, any dogmas, anything to follow, only Srila Prabhupada's personality and his being with us, sitting among us. This is what attracted us. His charm, his grace, his ease with every situation, no matter what it was. He was never off balance. Any question you asked him, he would know the answer immediately. And he always kept saying, Krishna, 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 Krishna. He told us that he could take us to this higher place. He called it Vaikuntha. He called it Vaikuntha Vrindavan. And we began to get an idea, maybe this place really does exist. And we can find it through this man because he has found it. We could see he has found it. He's always happy. He's always shining. He knows by when he looks around, he sees the same thing we see as a vision under some drug-induced vision. He sees the same thing all the time. And he can tell us how to attain this state. So practically speaking, we followed only Srila Prabhupada's personal example. From the day one, is that enough introduction.
It's up to you.
Guru Das. We were all together, friends. Sometimes we were strangers. But as we began to associate with Srila Prabhupada, we developed a sense of brotherhood and sisterhood. We were only 20, 25 people in the midst of this neighborhood. Now, if you can imagine Chaupati, Malabar, maybe, and one or two of these other surrounding neighborhoods filled only with young people. Millions of young people came to two places, San Francisco and New York. They inhabited an area called the Lower East Side in New York. This is where Prabhupada first came, to be greeted by thousands of young people. They inhabited all the apartments, all the flats. Every shop had to do with young people. It was like an invasion. Over a period of a couple of years, all the other people moved out of these neighborhoods, and the young people, seekers, moved in. It's hard to imagine now. No phenomenon has happened like this, social phenomenon, ever again or before that I know of. Where tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people gathered in one neighborhood to look for the answers to life. So in San Francisco, where we live, this area was called Haight-Ashbury. If you've heard the name, it just means a neighborhood, a crossing of two streets, Haight Street and Ashbury Street. That was given the name of the whole neighborhood. And in this neighborhood lived perhaps 50,000 to 100,000 young people like us. So the streets and sidewalks were filled with these crazy people. And everyone was looking for the alternate reality. They were dressing themselves in costumes of fantastical costumes from their imaginations. There were mountain men. There were mountain ladies. There were Red Indians. There were Edwardian English costumes. Everyone was wearing their fantasies. And the music brought us all together. The songs became the important things in our lives, the that we heard on the radio and that we bought the recordings. There were several rock and roll groups came up that began to convey messages that we were all very much attracted to. Like these Beatles and Bob Dylan, other people like that. So they attracted a bunch of otherwise strangers into these two big cities. There was a song called When You Come to San Francisco, please don't forget to wear flowers in your hair. We were laughing last night while we were up there. This is the perfect ending to the flower children generation, looking down and seeing all these flower blossoms flying around. So Prabhupada landed in the midst of this craziness. It was kind of a lunacy, but it was well policed, I mean, in the sense that people didn't go to great extremes. There wasn't crime much in the streets. It was love. Love and peace is what everyone was seeking. And Prabhupada came as someone who said, I know the answers. I can take you to this place of love and peace. He was about the only one of the Eastern gurus who began to show up, who actually sat in Haight-Ashbury and began to preach. The others would come, they would give one or two programs, then leave. But Prabhupada came and sat down with us. His apartment was right above our little temple. So we expected him every day at 7. Did we wait for kirtan when he came, or did we have a kirtan before he came?
We waited for him.
We waited for Prabhupada. When he came down, he would lead us in kirtan. And then he would speak for 15 or 20 minutes, and then have another kirtan. And when he spoke, we began to listen to his ideas about you're not this body, Krishna is the supreme personality, that the God is a person. Yes, we could understand that immediately. The very simple basics of Krishna consciousness he began to instill in us. And why? Why did we accept it? Why did we soak it up like nectar? Because we could see somebody in front of us who was just so full of beauty and grace. I mean, when you looked at Prabhupada, he was so beautiful. Sometimes he looked like a little child, a beautiful young child, or even a woman sometimes, a beautiful woman. He seemed to change before your eyes. Even sometimes I would look at him and see a beautiful cow, you know, like an Indian cow. He had that face, those eyes. Mm-hmm. We just came to sit there and look at Prabhupada every morning, just look at him. How could anybody be so beautiful? And then when he spoke, you know, most people when they speak, if they're beautiful and then they speak, you go, oh gosh, he should have kept his mouth shut. But when Prabhupada, then he spoke, even the beauty increased. And he instilled us with great hope for the future because he said, you can become like me. You can become like this. Become Krishna conscious. Just think about Krishna all the time. And here's how you do it. And then he taught us how we do it by this chanting process. So the early days were very liberal. And Prabhupada, we were all very rascals and thieves and every kind of nonsense you can imagine. We were full of it. But Prabhupada accepted and was tolerant of everything we did. And he just guided us very gently with a slight touch here and there towards the right way. Never said anything about, you must do this or else. It was always, he did say about the meat eating, and that was understood. The meat eating, the intoxication, illicit sex life, and the gambling. We all knew that was the prerequisite if we were going to advance in Krishna consciousness. But he never said, you have to do it before you can come in and listen to me. No, he said, if you want to make advancements, you should give up this illicit sex life. You get yourself married. But he didn't push. No pushing, no pushing. Gradually he brought us in. He didn't make us wear tilak. I was talking with Gurudas last night. We did wear tilak to the temple.
Yeah, because we thought it was a nice fashion statement.
Yeah, it fit in. It was our brand. All the other hippies had their brands. Our brand was tilak, which was Fuller's Earth. We bought some Fuller's Earth in the chemist shop, which is a white powder. And beads, we had those big red beads that Malati found in a bead shop somewhere. We didn't know beads are supposed to be. He said put 108 beads on a string, so we naturally got beads about that big. But no bead bags. We just wore them around our necks. We didn't know what a bead bag was. Prabhupada had a little bead bag, but we didn't have anything like that. And we burned incense because that was available. But that was about it as far as orthodox means. The rest was just Prabhupada. Carry on.
We were called flower children. Now we will continue with Srila Prabhupada 101 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. We both met Prabhupada approximately 39 years ago, in a little over a week, January 17th. I had heard about Prabhupada. He was in New York, living with Mukunda and Janaki in the poorest, poorest section of New York, where all the derelicts and alcoholics would be actually lying in the street. And Prabhupada, seeing in the heart of these souls, would even be friends with these people lying on the street when they were conscious. And as Samarashunda said, there were many leaders, but they were not leaders at the same time because that was the fashion. There were many gurus, but we had heard about the Swami living in New York and that he wanted to come to the West Coast. So, by Krishna's grace, we found a storefront temple, 518 Frederick Street, and it was the day that the Swami was coming, January 17th, 1967. So we went to the airport in a caravan of painted cars. In those days, like Shamashunda said, we wore our fantasies and we painted our cars with designs and artwork on the side. We had a Cadillac, a high-class car, and we painted the Hare Krishna mantra on the side. We called it the Krishna-lack.
It was a 1948 model.
Well, yes. It was an old Krishna-lack. But old didn't matter. When Prabhupada was trying to get his immigration visa, some women stepped up and said, "We will marry the Swami because if he marries an American citizen, then he can get his immigration visa." But Prabhupada explained, "I am sannyasi. I cannot do that." So then someone else, Dayananda and Nandarani, said, "We will adopt the Swami as our child." And he said, "What? They will say, what are you doing with such an old child?" He always had a unique way of seeing things. Chandramali Swami Prabhu and I were talking about how Prabhupada saw and made different language, like Muslimin instead of Muslim, and airship. He used the old colloquial language. And he saw things in a different way. Sometimes I jump ahead in history for the sake of the illustration. There was a man who saw Prabhupada on television in London. We had a television show. And then we were in Mumbai together, at that time Bombay, and we were in his clinic. He was a doctor. And we went to his clinic, and he was showing us around, and then he stopped and said, "I saw you on television, and now you're standing in my clinic. Isn't this a small world?" And Prabhupada said, "Yes, it is insignificant." And he walked into the elevator. So we went to the airport in our caravan of painted cars. Shamashunda was wearing a Moroccan shepherd's outfit that he got in Morocco. I was wearing a sort of samurai robe. And Mukunda was wearing a Merlin the Magician outfit with paisley. And everybody was wearing their different outfits, like you say, Native America. Somebody was there with a feather in their hair, with a bow and arrow. He told me his parents had invited him to his brother's wedding, but he had to either give up the tomahawk or the feather. So we went. The Swami was coming. The Swami's coming. And we went to the airport. We went to the observation place where you can see the airplane, who was getting off. Down the steps, everybody came, all the passengers. No Swamiji. No Swamiji. Then after about 3 minutes, emerging from the airplane was a saffron-robed saint. With his head held high to the heavens, he looked like Lord Chaitanya. He was so regal, like a king, he'd be looking around. Transcendental. And of course, if you're in an airplane, when it stops, everybody gets up and waits. Swamiji sits. That is the intelligent thing to do. Then everybody leaves, then you go. Everybody, the minute the plane stops, they get up and wait. It seemed like Prabhupada's feet were not touching the ground, like Yudhisthira's chariot would not touch the ground because he never lied. And Prabhupada never lied to us. He always lived and spoke the truth. My life is my message, Gandhi said. And Prabhupada's life was like that. We could see him and see that this person is Krishna conscious, and that's why we can follow him. He's living this. He's not just speaking empty words. And then he came into the airport, and he sat in the seat like some great bird, so expertly, it was like he just glided into the seat. And then with golden fingers, we saw him wrap the kartals with deliberation. Everything he did had purpose. He walked with purpose. He speaks with purpose. He wrapped the kartals, and we started chanting. We chanted so beautifully. Prabhupada led us. Then the airport officials started to come the way of the chanting because by now a crowd had gathered and surrounded us in the airport. It started to be obstruction from material life and entrance into spiritual life, even in the airport. And so they came to tell us to stop. But at that point, as they got there and Prabhupada's eyes were closed, he just stopped. So now they had nothing to do but just watch. And then Prabhupada got up and Mukunda was there with telling him where the Krishna Lakh was to take him to our storefront temple. And Prabhupada, in his humility, because Mukunda opened his arms to embrace him, embraced Mukunda. It wasn't until a long time that Prabhupada even told us about a Vyasa-san. He didn't tell us that there's a special seat representing Vyasadeva. He sat on our altar that Samashinda made. Samashinda was our first architect. When I met Samashinda in his house, we eventually moved in together. He said he might not be my friend, but I disagree with that. He was building some kind of architectural stairway to the ceiling.
That's right.
So he had this propensity to build. So he built our first altars and Vyasa-sans and helped with the Rath Yatra card, and in London he built the altar and built the Vyasa-san. So, in our storefront temple, Prabhupada would sit on the altar, and we were so ignorant. Someone brought a picture of Lord Jesus, put it in the temple. Prabhupada accepted it. Haridas brought a totem pole into the temple. This is a Native American, American Indian animals, eagles and coyotes, up to the ceiling, owl's wings. Prabhupada just let it be in, to the right of the altar. He didn't make us take it out. But I did notice when he'd eat oranges, he'd throw the orange peels and hit the eagle in the nose. Whap! 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 To illustrate our ignorance, our first artist, Haridas, Prabhupada told us eventually about Lord Chaitanya. He had to spoon-feed us. There were no books except for the Srimad Bhagavatam. He led the kirtans with bongo drums. There was no mridangas yet. Bongo drums. He led the kirtan, and they went on for hours. There was a little dwarf person playing a big kettle drum, and Hayagriva made trumpets out of kelp on the ocean. And people would come in, and there was a boy named Israel, and he said, "I like chanting, but how can it save people in the world?" And Prabhupada said, "You are different from people in the world. If you like chanting, then chant loudly. That's how you will save people in the world." But to show our ignorance, Haridas was then told about the Panchatattva, that there's these exalted souls, and Prabhupada told him about how that this would be a nice painting, but somehow or other, this Haridas, our first artist, thought they were women, like from Hawaii. And he painted them like women. And that was when Prabhupada came in the temple, that was the first time I saw him have an idea of, like, disapproval. It wasn't exactly disapproval, but he went, "Ah." And I saw him call Haridas over and talk to him. And then Haridas took the painting out, and then the next day, they were actually the bona fide Panchatattva. So, then, I'm going to let Shyamashinda tell how Lord Jagannath came about.
Well, something else you said a little earlier got me thinking, too, that most people's expectations of a spiritual guide, a spiritual master in those days, a guru, and mine too, and probably yours, was that after some time, if we kept coming, Prabhupada would reveal some magic thing to us, that he would touch us and we would become enlightened. This was a common understanding of the hippies was that you could become enlightened by the spiritual master in a magic way by touching.
Shakti.
Or by Shakti or something. So we kept waiting. When's Prabhupada going to zap us, you know, in the beginning? And then we began to understand that the process was a little slower than that, that you had to become qualified. He said purified. And we go, "Uh-oh." but he kept giving us hope, you know. But actually, this works very fast, this process, he said also. We would think, "Oh, no, it's going to take years to become purified." But then he would tell the stories like the person who died with the name of his son on his lips. By saying the son's name, he immediately became God-conscious. Yes. And stories like that, it can happen much faster also. And Prabhupada, the nice thing about that period, the most wonderful thing to me was the fact that Prabhupada, although such a great saintly man who knew everything about any subject, the reservoir of all knowledge, he put himself in our hands. We were supposed to take care of him and teach him. We were teaching him about America. We were teaching him about the young people, the youth of that period. And he was learning avidly from us at the same time that we were learning from him. He would observe. He would stand in his window and just observe things in the street and then ask us questions about it. "What is this? Why is that person doing that like that?
What are these do-nots?" He saw a donut sign and he said, "What are these do-nots?" He thought they were rules for America.
A do-not shop.
Yeah.
There was a long period, like Gurudas was describing, when we didn't know how to, there was an altar, a crude altar, but there was nothing on it except a kind of a hodgepodge, a Native American totem pole. I think Buddha was there too somewhere. Buddha was there, and there was a picture of Christ and some crude paintings of the Panchatattva and one or two renderings of Krishna. There were some posters available in the psychedelic bookshops in the neighborhood, imported from India, with pictures of Krishna, one or two pictures. One was the Krishna sitting with the leg folded back, touching the cow, that one. And one with, of course, the ones with four arms. We didn't understand this four-arm, six-arm, eight-arm business. This was, Prabhupada would explain to us how these expansions of Krishna came about, and then we gradually understood. Gradually, he made us understand that Krishna was the origin of everything, but slowly, slowly. So you, I think it was Gurudas, you were passing one day, there was only one, none of us had ever even met an Indian person before. There were no Indian people in the United States, even in a big city like San Francisco. But people had heard about things from India, and India was becoming more and more popular in people's imagination because of the music that was being played by Ravi Shankar, this mystical sounding sitar music was, it was captivating. People were, all of the hippies were taking up this music and listening to it. So there was a little shop in downtown San Francisco called India Imports. I think it was on Ellis Street. And Gurudas was walking by there one day, and he saw a little statue, a little blue boy, and he inquired about it, and they said, yes, this is Krishna. And he told us about it, but they wanted, I think it was $55 or
something. $35.
Well, that's what you talked him down to, wasn't it? I think it was more than that originally, which was way beyond our means. We had barely enough for the rent, if that. So we let it go by for some weeks, and then finally one morning Gurudas walked in with the deity of Kartamishan, Krishna. He talked them down into price, and
I had no money. I went out in the street and said, "My son is in jail. My father's in jail." And soon the money came, and then I paid. "My father's in jail."
But finally, we had a form of Krishna on the altar. But no, there was no arti or anything like that. We didn't have any clue what arti was, or deity worship. This was totally unknown, and Prabhupada did not even mention it. He was still trying to get us to stop drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes.
And bringing dogs into the temple.
And bring our dogs into the temple. Can you imagine all of this? Anyway, finally, I guess it's an old story, but you know, these old stories of Krishna consciousness and Prabhupada are ever fresh. If you hear a story that's been told 50 or 100 times, normally you become very bored with this story. If it's the story of some secular person doing this or doing that, it becomes boring. But with Srila Prabhupada, it seems to be an ever refreshing experience to hear these stories. Mm-hmm. That, well, to give it a little background, of course, because we were already in tune with this spirit of magic, that things didn't happen anymore by cause and effect. This was a bit major change in consciousness that was going on around the youth of America in those days. That things didn't happen by cause and effect. They happened by magic. Things just happened by magic. We were all imbued with this spirit. I mean, everything we did was we expected a magic result to happen. We didn't think about tomorrow or the next day or anything. Just whatever I'm doing, there's some magic involved. So when Malati came to Prabhupada with that little figurine that she had found in the import shop of Lord Jagannath, we all thought, immediately, because Prabhupada's reaction was he bowed down to this little figurine. This was quite shocking to see, to try to understand. And Prabhupada told us that this was God. This outlandish figure. And of course we all went, oh, okay, yeah, why not? Because it was magic. If Prabhupada, Swamiji said that it was God, yeah, okay, wow, that's cool.
Then a new sampradaya happened when people would find bigger images of Lord Jagannath and they started wearing them around their neck. This big, then this big. But Prabhupada didn't like the idea of putting the screw there in the top, so he had to stop doing that.
And then they were using glue. But I don't know, I wasn't in the room when he saw it for the first time, but Malati describes it as being a very rare moment. And he asked her if there were two others of these figurines, and she said, yes, there were two others. So I said, bring those also, and she got them. And he asked her if anyone knew woodworking or carving, and she said, well, my husband, Shyamasundara, knows. I was doing a carpentry business in those days. I even though I was trained in university and had a degree and all that, it was in philosophy, which is a useless subject for making money. So I thought, well, to make some money, I will learn how to work wood, you know, pound nails and work as a construction worker, and which I did. And I had a small business. So she said I knew how to work with wood, and that's when Prabhupada said, well, then ask him to come up and see me. And Prabhupada held up the little Jagannath. He said, can you make this? And he said, about this big? I said, yes, I can do that. He said, very good. And we talked some more about what the materials, they should be wood. He had explained to us now why the figure was shaped like it was, why the paint was that way, and so on. And we understood then that this was Krishna. So he assigned me that task. That was my very, well, second task. A task for service for Srila Prabhupada. The first one was to be a bookkeeper, which didn't last very long. He taught me double entry bookkeeping. I came up to his room every day and sat with him just like this, right beside him on the floor. And he had his little table there, and he put his glasses on and take his pen and show me in the books how you enter the amount coming in, the income, and the expenditure. And every penny must match. But after 3 or 4 days, it became impossible to keep track of the flow of money. It wasn't much, but somebody would go out and buy something and not tell me, no receipt. So I spent all of my time trying to get track down the receipts for this and that so Prabhupada wouldn't be upset. Finally, I said to him, he would say, your books do not match. Say, Srila Prabhupada, it's very difficult. I'm not very good at this. And so he kind of dismissed me from that service.
Prabhupada said in one of his short aphorisms that accounting means putting it down immediately. Mm. And there was one accountant, he said, I don't have to do that. And we went around Mumbai, and after we went around, I asked him to recount what we did that day. And I said, but you forgot the ride from the Victoria Station to such and such a place. So he said, ah, oh, Prabhupada's right. So that was the accounting. He'd say to me, did you get a receipt? And I'd say, what's a receipt? And he'd say, but you American boys and girls have never been trained. He'd always be compassionate to us.
Yeah, you are the sons and daughters of rich people. You don't care about these things. I think Uddhava became the treasurer, right?
Yeah.
Uddhava, yeah. Uddhava was much better at it. Anyway, the second service then was for carving these. But we had begun to we had developed our love for Srila Prabhupada, the Swamiji, don't forget. Prabhupada was not a name that we used in those days. It came some years later. It was Swamiji, or the Swami. Our love had been growing with Swamiji to the point where we didn't want to be away from him. And we had our God brothers, at that time they were just the two branches in New York. And they were always trying to steal Prabhupada away from us by sending him glowing descriptions of what was going on in New York. And we were, on the other hand, always trying to, in a competition, a kind of a competition, we were always trying to attract him to stay in San Francisco by Gurdas was arranging programs out ahead, you know, television shows, radio shows, newspaper interviews, things like that. Prabhupada, you have to stay because 2 weeks from now we have that television show.
Right.
So we began to learn early on that the love of our life, we couldn't exist without Prabhupada by then. He was our sole reason for being. And just to think about him leaving us was more than we could bear. So I contrived to go very slowly on this carving of this Jagannath, because Prabhupada said that he was going to stay until we installed the Jagannath deity in the temple. So week after week went by. I got the wood, and I was working in my house slowly, and Prabhupada became a little bit anxious. He would ask me after 1 month passed, how is the work on Jagannath coming? I mean, it's a very simple carving job. It only takes, really, if someone wanted to do it quickly, they could do it in 48 hours, probably. But I kept saying, well, I'm having trouble with the wood, Srila Prabhupada. It's cracking. I have to repair it and then wait for the glue to dry and the this and that. I always had some excuse, and he would go, okay. But eventually it became a bit too obvious that it was taking so long. So he began to push a little bit, even to the extent of telephoning. He would telephone my house. What is the progress today, Shyam Sundar? Oh, I'm waiting for the white paint to dry, Srila Prabhupada, so that I can put on the green paint. And one day he showed up at the house. I heard a little knock, knock, knock. And that means he walked all the way from across the Haight-Ashbury district, which is probably a couple of miles, down these wild streets of chaos with hundreds and thousands of people jostling him in the street, young people doing crazy things. And I can imagine what he encountered just to walk over to my house.
Just like India.
Yeah, much like India. Well, that was his... We always wondered why he remained so unflappable in the midst of all this. And he said, I'm an old Calcutta man.
Yes.
Means nothing bothered him. But he knocked on the door. I was so surprised. And he came in with his cane. He was very sober and grim. Not grim, but... you know, the look.
Grave.
Grave. Yes, let me see. So, Jagannath was laying on the floor there, almost complete. So, and I was still smoking cigarettes. Prabhupada had never really pushed that point.
Yeah.
In fact, in the beginning, I can remember, as soon as Prabhupada left the room to go up to his apartment, we would all run out on the sidewalk and smoke.
At Kirtan, it was like it was a cinema event or a theater of intermission. We'd go out, okay, do you have a cigarette?
True confessions. And he saw that. And it was sitting on the Jagannath's head.
On his head?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was his feet.
No, it was on his head. My empty packet. And he said, what is this? And I said, Prabhupada, those are our cigarettes. He took his cane and whap, knocked him across the room and just said quietly, no more cigarettes. But I could see I couldn't put it off much longer, so I finished it up and brought it to the temple. And we installed it. I don't remember the ceremony. Do you remember the?
Yeah.
Oh, talk about that.
Well, I just wanted to tell another aspect of this. Later on in London, Shyamashinda brought a whole... He's always a visionary thinker. So he brought a whole shipload of redwood in case we found a temple to build. So he was building what looked like an upside-down ship with redwood in the middle of London. And Prabhupada, after we were living outside, Prabhupada came to live in that building, and he was above the temple. And Shyamashinda or somebody said, maybe Tirthapada said, oh, should we, is the hammering disturbing you? And he said, no, I want to hear the hammering. Then I know you're working. This is how Prabhupada thinks. So, as Shyamashinda said, I used to see Mukunda. Prabhupada would see us Tuesdays and Thursdays sometimes. We'd have darshan, but not much association. And it was three times a week kirtan, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 7 o'clock in the morning, 7 at night. So I saw, how is it that Mukunda has so much association and Hayagriva with Prabhupada? They were doing some service. I got the idea, well, I can do some service. So Prabhupada called me one day, because I was the first photographer. He said, he called me, and he was asking me about cameras for a friend of his in India. He said, is Pentax good? And I said, yes. And then I brought him a catalog the next day. And I realized that this is so nice to be in his presence. So then I thought of any excuse. I'd bring him another catalog. One day I showed him how the light meter works on a camera. And Prabhupada played with it for 20 minutes. The needle moved when it took your hand off the light. And Prabhupada played with it for 20 minutes. He played with baby Kishori, a game. She would run to his vyasa, his asana, and he would ruffle her head, and she would laugh, and then she would run. And they were doing it for like a half an hour, like she was a dog with a ball. When is this going to stop? And Prabhupada would play and play. So I like to be in his presence. So I would think of any excuse. So finally they said... And Prabhupada gave me another name first, and then in the middle of the initiation, he said, no, Guru Das. So my other name is with an R, but he gave me the name. So they said, don't let Guru Das in anymore. He's always coming. And so their idea was to not let me in anymore, but somehow or other, Krishna arranged it. When they went into the kitchen, that's when I had decided, I'm going to go see the Swami today. So they come back, oh, Guru Das is there again. So I was photographing. And Prabhupada, his expressions would change so markedly. Even when he'd do a miracle. Like one time, there was a butterfly, and he put out his finger, and the butterfly jumped on his finger. And I was going to photograph it, but I didn't want to spoil the mood. And then the butterfly flew off, and Prabhupada just went into the next expression. And then a few minutes later, he said, open the window so that butterfly can get something to eat. That's how he saw into the hearts of every living entity, animals and plants. And so I would photograph him, and I was photographing him a lot, because his expressions were so special. And he said, there is a super... he said, why you were photographing me so much? And I said, because I love you. And your expressions changed so markedly. He said, there is a superstition in India that when somebody is photographing, it shortens their life. And I was going, I stopped and froze. And he said, "What do you think of that?" And I gained my composure and said, "It is not how long one lives, it's what someone does with their life." And he said, "Yes, that is just a superstition." He would tease us to see. And so the Lord Jagannath was installed with a very nice but simple ceremony. It wasn't the full artik. And Prabhupada would chant. Eventually we had a Vyasa-san. And one night, we chanted a long time because we didn't have books. And when Prabhupada did speak, he was like just giving this idea, we're not this body. He'd have to do it very simple because we were all just learning. So one night we heard thumping on the wall. Bang. After the kirtan, bang. Next door lived the Hell's Angels. The fiercest two-wheeler motorcycle gang in the world. They would go into whole towns and destroy the town. It was called trashing the town. Trash the town. They did heinous things that I don't even want to mention. And they were next door to us. And so Prabhupada called me up to the Vyasa-san and said, "What is that noise? Go see." So I went out into the fresh air night, and I said, "Krishna, why me?" Why did he ask me? And I knocked on the door, and this fierce-looking man with swastikas out of his ears and tattoo 13, beard, muscles, he looked like a demon. I had my cartels, he had his knife. I had my japa bag, he had his two-wheeler, called Hogs. So I said, "The Swami is about to talk. Is it possible that you party less loudly?" And he says, "Yes, we were thumping on the wall because we like your singing." So I said, "Well, when the singing stops, if you don't mind stopping thumping for a while, that would be very nice." Later on, at our mantra rock dance, they became our security because we were afraid of them. So if they're our security, that was the security against themselves. So they became our security.
So Prabhupada was teaching us devotional service in a practical way. He would could talk about devotional service, but you can see now looking back how he drew us into actual devotional service. We became attracted to him like Krishna. Like, I mean, we felt the same. We had the same feelings of longing to be with him as we would for Krishna later. But in the beginning, it was just Prabhupada. We'd do anything to be in his association, and we gave up all types of modesty. To be in his association, we would. So in this way, he enlisted us in devotional service. This is the secret of devotional service: that you want to please him so much, your spiritual master or Krishna, that whatever you're doing, you do it twice as hard, twice as with more expertise and concentration, focus than you've ever done anything, because you want to please your spiritual master. And later, you know, then he was able to make us understand that this is what devotional service is. That Krishna is the same way. He's a person. And he wants to interact with us in devotional service. But it's up to us to make that step and surrender to the idea that everything I do should be for him. And that bliss that we began to feel by seeing that smile on Prabhupada's face replaced every other thing in our lives. If we could make Prabhupada smile or laugh, this was the goal of our existence. It brought up qualities in us that we didn't know we had. Mm. All the devotees, and like Radhanath was saying last night, that you know everyone began to feel that Prabhupada is giving only me his attention, that he's pleasing me completely. But he's doing the same thing to all the devotees at the same time. His ability to accept and return devotional service was perfect. And everyone, all of us felt that Prabhupada was only for him or only for her, that he was my friend.
This is analogous to the Ras Lila, where everyone thought that Krishna was paying a special attention. And Prabhupada, representative, we don't know Krishna so well, but here's a living example. And it's like that. When Prabhupada would look in our direction, we would leave the milk boiling on the stove or run to him. Like Krishna playing the flute in the night, we would run. He was the center of our life, and the currency was to see Prabhupada smile like that. They say, how did you do all this? We didn't do anything, but we just wanted to see Prabhupada smile. So like Shyamashindu was saying, then we started to be selfless, not thinking about ourselves so much. So then Prabhupada wanted some radio and television, so I arranged a radio program. And it was a call-in program. What people do is call in questions. So we were very clever little people, and so we decided we'll have the call-in ourselves. So the first one was Garga Muni, and he said, Swamiji, what's the meaning of life? And Prabhupada would answer for 20 minutes. And then Uddhava would call out, why are we here? And Prabhupada would answer for another 20 minutes. So then the radio person got the idea. He said, I'm going to have a different viewpoint. And they would screen the calls beforehand. So this woman calls in and says, Swamiji, why are you preaching to the hippies? And Prabhupada said, they are not hippies, they are happies. And then she said, why is your so-called temple in the Haight-Ashbury? And Prabhupada said, so-called? It has deities. It has scriptures. It has worship. So she said, okay, why is your temple in the Haight-Ashbury? So Prabhupada said, inexpensive rent. So she said, how did you get here? And he said, I got here by free passage on the Sindhya line. So she said, are you a freeloader? And Prabhupada had never heard the word, so he said, yes. And then we heard her, like, gasp, and then he cut her off. Now, before the program, Prabhupada was sitting silently, and they were doing what's called a sound check to make sure the sound is clear. And there was a buzz in the line, so they were looking at the wires for 1 hour. They were following them and checking their boards and sound, and they followed it back and followed it back. And finally they said, it's him, it's him. It was Prabhupada. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. It's him, it's him.
This was such a powerful, dynamic period of time. It only lasted about 1 or 1.5 years. And during that period, so many great devotees came. Because Prabhupada was the only place in all of that hundreds and thousands of people where you could go and sit down and listen to an actual Swami from the Far East, from India, from mystical India, speak. And so gradually great devotees who turned into great devotees started coming one by one. If you look back, so many of the incredible stars of ISKCON came during that period. We were all just Vishnu young boys Chan. And girls.
Vishnu Chan.
But the flavor of the whole experience was, let's expand. Let's not just sit here in our temple and develop the temple nicely. We never had anything more than just a a fresh coat of paint on the walls and a new rug. That was about it, the only improvements we made, except for the altar. The altar was, Prabhupada asked us to build an altar because of, for Lord Jagannath, and we had no idea or conception what is an altar, except from our experience in Christian churches. And in Christian churches, the Christ figure is usually very high up in the back of the altar, but on top, Christ on the cross. So we built this, the room was very high, probably almost this high, wasn't it, the ceiling?
No.
Maybe not quite. No. Okay, maybe but 14 feet.
Or he more. Always sees things grandiose.
It was higher than a normal ceiling.
Okay.
So I built this altar way up near the top so that you had to look up like this. And Lord Jagannath sat up there. And then Prabhupada said we should put a canopy over. And so the girls sewed a canopy of brightly colored cloth over the deity. And then we decided, well, we should put some lights. So, I mean, this is the hippie age and psychedelic age. So we put spotlights of red, green, yellow, red, green, and yellow. And we put them on a blinker system so that they would flash like this. So there's Jagannath sitting way up there with these psychedelic lights flashing on him. And he was, of course, all brightly painted also. So the whole vision was, I mean, it was really awesome. Awesome. Awesome thing to see. Hippies walking by in the street. But there was a big picture window in the front. The whole front of the shop was a window. So they looked in and saw that. They thought, wow, this is cool. Let's go in and see what this is. And we would always point up and say, that's God. Oh, yeah, right. That's God, right?
Groovy, man.
Groovy. Far out. So many great devotees started coming to this. But as soon as they got in place and learned the basics, just the raw basics of Krishna consciousness, they would go out. Devotees would go out to start a new temple somewhere else. Let's spread the word. Because Prabhupada, as our only example, he came from all the way from India. He traveled over great, overcame great adversities, took great risk. So this became our modus operandi also. Prabhupada told us from the very beginning that Krishna really likes his devotees who take great risks for him, and that he must personally get himself involved in removing obstacles for these risk-taking devotees. So we wanted to get to Krishna as fast as possible, so we thought, well, we better do like Prabhupada says and take some great risks. And besides, everything was kind of an adventure anyway. I mean, here we are in this room with this man from the across the globe who has reached enlightenment. He's in some kind of other state of being. And things are going on around us that are totally new and adventuresome. So the spirit of adventure gripped us all. We wanted to spread Krishna consciousness like our Swamiji did. So some devotees went out to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and started a center out there. Communications weren't very well developed in those days, so we would get a letter occasionally what was going on in Santa Fe. Then some other devotees went down to Los Angeles, started a center there. Some other devotees went to
Seattle
and Denver. And like that, like you're doing here, in a way, spreading out Pune and Belgaum, other cities around. We did that very quickly in the beginning, started spreading Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada, it seemed to please Prabhupada when he could start saying, well, what is the news from Denver? What is the news from Seattle? And that's how the whole thing began to grow and expand.
But Prabhupada actually had to really tell us we are movement. We were content to just sit with our father and be spoon-fed. He was teaching us cooking and everything. And we were chanting and we were happy. It was like when I was coming from Amritsar to Mumbai with Prabhupada in the Delhi. I was sitting in the Delhi station with Prabhupada in the first-class compartment. I was just looking out the window in the station. Dude, dude, Pani, Pani, Pani. And Prabhupada, this man comes in and starts talking Hindi, and then Prabhupada says, get down and see what you can do. Who will you take with you? He kicked me out of the train. I thought I was coming to Mumbai. So we were sitting in the San Francisco temple, and we were content. But then Prabhupada, one night, he said, I want 108 temples. Now, and then I knew, now we are a movement. And that's and these people who came, Tamal Krishna, Vishnu Janar, Madhavisa, Ribadi Nandan Swami, Subal, so many great devotees came. They, Tamal and Vishnu Janar and Ribadi Nandan Madhavisa came from Morning Star Ranch, this ranch that the owner was intelligent enough to put in the name of God. And then he was able to keep it when they wanted to take it away from him. And I remember Tamal coming back to the ranch, and already he was enthusiastic. And he said to the owner of the ranch, now you've got to do bhakti, bhakti. And the owner of the ranch was a musician, so he started to play Bach on the piano.
Well, as far as personally we were concerned, we also began to feel that we should go out and spread Krishna consciousness somewhere else. We had gotten into a routine in San Francisco, going to the temple every morning, and we developed some fledgling businesses to support the temple. So things were pretty much evening out and getting started, but we wanted to keep the momentum going. So we started thinking about Prabhupada, to please Prabhupada the most, the best place would be to go to London, because London was Prabhupada kept talking about over and over and over again, that his Guru Maharaj had wanted to start a temple, a center in London. And in those days, the focus of young people's attention began to shift from San Francisco to London. The scene was moving overseas. It was coming, becoming centered around the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and these other rock and roll groups in London. And a new kind of dress was coming, the styles of fashion dressing was coming from England, from London, which was in those days bright clothes, as bright as you could wear, with stripes and polka dots and patterns, paisley patterns, funny shoes. This was all becoming the rage, and it was all coming out of London. So we discussed amongst ourselves, how can we possibly get to London? We wanted to make sure we had a plan first. And then by some miracle, I got a check from the government, U.S. government, for almost $2,000, $1,500. That's another story, but it has to do with Prabhupada, so I'll tell it. Before becoming a devotee, before meeting Srila Prabhupada, Malati and I had been arrested by the police in Seattle, Washington, for selling this LSD and other drugs. They caught us, the police caught us, red-handed. And they sentenced us to 5 years in prison. 5 years. So we put it off by appealing the case. And then meanwhile, we met Srila Prabhupada. And then the time came, we had to pay the price. They said, you have to be report to the jail in Seattle on this such and such a date. So we went to see Srila Prabhupada and said, Srila Prabhupada, we have to leave you now. This was the most crushing moment of our lives, because we thought we would have to go to jail for 5 years. Mm. That would be the end of it. We wouldn't see Prabhupada. It was the worst moment of my life. We sat with Prabhupada with tears coming out of our eyes and said we had to leave. So Prabhupada naturally inquired, why? Where were you going? We have to go to jail. And Prabhupada said, never mind. He says, Krishna was born in jail. This is all right. This is not a problem. He was always telling us, minimizing our problems, like a father. And then he inquired, why are you going to, why do you have to go to jail? And we said, well, we were caught by the police for selling drugs. And he says, that's all right. He says, I also was a drug dealer. Minimizing. And he said, well, if you go, then here, I will show you how to maintain the chanting. And he got some little pieces of paper and wetted them with his tongue, and he rolled them into little balls. And he said, now you just put a string. He took his dhoti up, and he tore a string out from his dhoti. And he said, you put these little balls around the string, and these will be your chanting beads. So he showed us how to do that. And he kept trying to calm us down and say, everything will be all right. You don't worry. Just think about Krishna. Everything will be all right. So off we went to this. And at the time of my being caught by the police, I had $2,000 in my pocket in cash, which was a huge sum in those days. And the police had confiscated it. Well, we went to jail. That's another story. We went to the jail. And within 30 days, we were somehow or other released. To this day, I'm not sure how or why. But they came one day to the cell and opened the cell and said, you are free to go. And we came back to see Srila Prabhupada in San Francisco. We were so ecstatic. Prabhupada just shook his head like this, you know. He didn't say anything. Anyway, so that money was ultimately returned to us in the mail. We got a refund back from the government, just out of the blue. Ah, here was our money to go to London, we thought, right away. So we began to make the plans for going to London. In those days, the most influential people in the world, Prabhupada always said to us, he said, you go to the most influential people. Train them in Krishna consciousness first, and then the rest will follow. His example was, even before he came to the U.S., he used to go to see the president of India, and he wrote letters to Mahatma Gandhi. He was always trying to get the leaders of India to accept his mission. And he instilled the same desire in us to go to the leaders of society and convince them. I'm not sure when it happened, but he even formed a political party, and some of the devotees ran for president. Should we stop before? Yeah.
Because we're going to continue this later on with the photos, some that have never been seen, some from the early days, black and white, that I rendered.
So. Yeah. So I'll leave it at that. We were just getting organized to go to London. Should we ask for questions?
Sure.
Anyone have any questions about the San Francisco period? This afternoon there will be at what time?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Gurudas has prepared a slideshow of never-before-seen photographs from the early days that he took.
So Maharaj said, by human eyes, and I was thinking, does that make me inhuman?
He did say that, human
yes.
eyes. That's a little bit overboard, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, Gurudas's books just arrived, two cases of these books. This book is not about Gurudas. This book is about Srila Prabhupada, all the things that Gurudas remembers that Srila Prabhupada said and did in small anecdotal form. This book, next to Lilamrita, is the most insightful book in Srila Prabhupada that we have, in my estimation. So you're very fortunate that these arrived somehow by magic, as they had been lost by the shipping company. Nobody knew where they were. And 2 days ago, they showed up magically. So he has 200 of these books for sale. And anyone who wants to really understand the intimate side of Srila Prabhupada should buy this book. When are you going to, sell it during the program today?
I guess after the afternoon session.
Find a good site for your table this time.
Yeah, out there in
He has a very he's such a wonderful soul, but he doesn't have a very practical line. Last night he put his book table over in the far corner in the dark. Nobody could see. I said, Gurdas, put your table right by the exit. Then they have to see you.
Prabhupada said when we were trying to get the land from Mr. Nair, he said, you should go speak to Mr. Nair because you get along with everyone. But then he said, but you don't have any business sense. So then he said, Tamal Krishna, you should go speak with him. You have good business sense, but you don't get along with anyone. So, so I have to do it.
So read about hundreds of... So there are hundreds of such stories like he just told in here. You should read this. This is unbelievable.
Thank you.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai.
Jai.